This paper is entitled Erasmus Anecdotes by Jeffrey T. Riddle. It was given at the Mid-Atlantic Regional Meeting of the Society for Biblical Literature meeting in New Brunswick, New Jersey on March 11, 2016. October 31st, 2017 will mark the 500th anniversary of Martin Luther posting his 95 Theses to the church door at Wittenberg to ignite the Protestant Reformation. Numerous commemorations, events, and conferences will, no doubt, observe this milestone. Less celebrated, though still remembered by some, was another milestone passed on March 1, 2016, marking the 500th anniversary of the printing of Erasmus's Novum Instrumentum Omne, which provided the first published Greek New Testament alongside the Latin Vulgate and Erasmus's own Latin translation. It has been suggested that Erasmus's primary purpose in the Novum Instrumentum was, in fact, to present his Latin translation as a correction to the Vulgate. The Greek text then merely appeared initially as a supplement to this primary purpose. Nevertheless, it was Erasmus's Greek text in the New Testament that proved to have the most lasting influence. Five editions of this work appeared during Erasmus's lifetime: 1516, 1519, 1522, 1527, and 1536. It also served as the basis for further editions of the printed Greek New Testament, including those produced by Robert Estienne, or as he is better known, Robertus Stephanus. Theodore Beza, Calvin's colleague and successor in Geneva, in turn published no less than four distinct editions, besides reprints based on Stephanus' text. In 1633, when the enterprising Elsevier brothers published their second edition of the Greek New Testament based largely on Beza's 1565 edition, they famously added the promotional blurb to the preface: Textum ergo habes, nunc ab omnibus receptum. Therefore, you have the text now by all received, from which came the term Textus Receptus. The second edition of Erasmus's Greek text undergirded Luther's German translation of the New Testament in 1522, and the third edition, Tyndale's English New Testament in 1525. The mature John Calvin also embraced this text in his later New Testament commentaries. Erasmus's Textus Receptus became the basis for all the vernacular translations of Europe in the Protestant Reformation era. It was the object of study, exegesis, and exposition in the writings of the magisterial Protestant reformers and those who followed after them. Thus, well has it been quipped that Erasmus laid the egg which Luther hatched. We may even say that perhaps the 500-year anniversary of the Reformation in 2017 would not be observed if we did not first mark the 500th anniversary of the Novum Instrumentum Omne in 2016. Erasmus's Textus Receptus reigned supreme throughout the Reformation and post-Reformation eras, though it was not without its critics. Metzger observes, having secured an undeserved preeminence, which came to be called the Textus Receptus of the New Testament, resisted for 400 years all scholarly efforts to displace it in favor of an earlier and more accurate text. Finally, in the 19th century, the reigning influence of the Textus Receptus was challenged with the publication of Karl Lachmann's Greek New Testament in 1831. A more decisive blow came with the publication of Westcott and Hort's Greek New Testament in 1881. As Eldon J. Epp put it, quote, "If D-Day belonged to Lachmann, V-Day, 50 years later, belonged to the undisputed general of the army, F.J. A. Hort, and his first officer, B.F. Westcott," end quote. The supposedly antiquated Textus Receptus was replaced by the modern critical text as the standard for both the church and the academy. This replacement, however, did not come without leaving some pockets of stiff resistance. Among the most outspoken critics of the modern critical text when it first appeared was the fiery John W. Bergen, or Dean Bergen. The modern text also found more temperate critics in F.H.A. Scrivener and George Salmon. It is the contention of this paper that during the 19th century, as part of the effort to topple the Textus Receptus and support the rise of the modern critical text, a number of unflattering scholarly anecdotes regarding Erasmus's Greek text began to circulate in secondary literature on the text and translation of the New Testament. Several of these anecdotes have taken on legendary, if not mythic, proportions, having been passed from scholar to scholar and from student to student without any firm evidence or proof from primary sources to support their veracity. Furthermore, these anecdotes continue to be retold from teaching lecterns and to be reprinted in contemporary works on text and translation. We will briefly examine two of what I am calling these Erasmian anecdotes. The first is the rush to print anecdote, and the second is the rash wager anecdote. First, let's look at the rush to print anecdote. One of the most commonly perpetuated accounts regarding the first edition, 1516, of Erasmus's Novum Instrumentum is that it was riddled with numerous errors because Erasmus was pressured by the printer Froben to complete the work as quickly as possible so that it might reach the market before the Complutensian edition, which was being prepared in Spain. This view is taken for granted in most discussions of this topic in both academic and popular works. The idea is typically presented as an accepted historical fact with little, if any, reference or examples to validate the claim. If there is a footnote, it typically appeals to secondary sources from another scholar who likewise presents this information without evidence. It is simply passed on as an assured result of scholarship or as a generally accepted fact. Here is a representative survey providing some examples of the perpetuation of this anecdote from the 19th century up to the present day. Samuel P. Tregelis, in his 1854 discussion of Erasmus's Novum Instrumentum, notes, quote, "It appears that Froben, the printer of Basel, wished to anticipate the Greek New Testament, which was, as he heard, in preparation in Spain," end quote. He continues, quote, "The first edition of Erasmus was thus printed and published in extreme haste," end quote. B.B. Warfield, in his 1886 Introduction to Text Criticism, describes Erasmus's 1516 edition as hurried through the press at breakneck speed in the effort to forestall the Complutensian polyglot. J. Harold Greenlee, in his 1964 Introduction to Text Criticism, observes, quote, "Although the Complutensian was the first edition to be printed, it was not the first to be published, actually placed on the market. A Swiss printer, Froben, hearing of the cardinal's anticipated edition, sought out the scholar Erasmus in September 1515 and asked him to prepare an edition of the Greek New Testament as quickly as possible," end quote. Bruce Metzger, in his influential The Text of the New Testament, Its Transmission, Corruption, and Restoration, offers this description, quote, "Doubtless, Froben had heard of the forthcoming Spanish polyglot Bible, and sensing that the market was ready for an edition of the Greek New Testament, wished to capitalize upon that demand before Ximenes' work would be finished and ready for publication," end quote. He continues, quote, "The printing began on 2 October 1515, and in a remarkably short time, 1 March 1516, the entire edition was finished. A large folio volume of about 1,000 pages that, as Erasmus himself declared later, was precipitated rather than edited. Praecipitatum varius quam editum. Owing to the haste in production, the volume contains hundreds of typographical errors. In fact, Scrivener once declared, it is in that respect the most faulty book I know," end quote. This rush to print anecdote, however, was openly challenged by the Oxford Erasmian scholar M.A. Screech in his introduction to a 1986 scholarly edition of Erasmus's Annotations on the Gospels. Screech raised at least five different objections related to the rush to print anecdote. First, Screech points out that Erasmus's references to the speedy publication of his project in 1516 refers to the printing process, not to Erasmus's preparation of the material. He says, quote, "Since the printing of the work as a whole did not begin until 2 October 1515, it was set up and printed with some considerable speed. Dashed out, precipitatus, is the term Erasmus used," end quote. Again, according to Screech, it was the printing process, not the preparation process, which was speedily done between October 2, 1515, when Erasmus delivered his material to Froben, and March 1, 1516, the dated colophon on the finished first edition. Second, Screech also defends Erasmus's first edition of the Novum Instrumentum from the charge of sloppiness. He acknowledges that Erasmus was encouraged by Froben and others to, quote, "make fundamental modifications and additions to his text as he went along," end quote, so that, quote, "the Greek of the New Testament itself was modified during printing, not always by Erasmus in person," end quote, and that the annotations were, as he puts it, recast and expanded in proof up to the last moment in what must have been a nightmare. Nevertheless, Screech concludes, quote, "Yet the 1516 annotations are remarkably free from misprints. Even the Greek New Testament is not quite so full of them as is often alleged," end quote. Third, Screech points out the tendency of mainstream New Testament scholars to detract from Erasmus's work, and even to pass on what he calls fantasies and legends about it. He offers this sharp assessment, quote, "Anyone who reads New Testament scholarship finds that Erasmus has his detractors who repeat each other with bland assurance. Writers of established reputation pass on fantasies or legends. Few of those who do show much acquaintance with the annotations," end quote. Fourth, Screech takes particular exception to the notion that Erasmus's first edition was a rush job to beat the Spanish Complutician polyglot to the market. In fact, he dismisses the whole notion as a completely legendary fabrication. His comments on this point are worth hearing in full. Quote, "One legend, repeated from book to book for a century or more, asserts that Erasmus and Froben hurriedly skimped their work in order to steal a march on better scholars based in Spain. In Alcala de Henares, or Complutum in Latin, a team of scholars and theologians were working under Cardinal Ximenes and Lopez Stunica. Their aim was eventually fulfilled in a major work of scholarship, the Complutensian Polyglot, the complete Bible with texts in Hebrew, Greek, Aramaic, and Latin. It is a fact that the New Testament forming part of this polyglot had already been set up and printed at Complutum by 10 January 1514, 2 years before Erasmus's edition appeared on sale. But the work was not published, the intention being to bring out the volumes all together. Manuscripts were sent from the Vatican, and funds seemed limitless. Eventually, a papal faculty to publish was granted on 22 March 1520. But even then, there was delay, and it was not put on sale until 1522. Erasmus and Froben had no need to hurry. Alcala de Henares is the home of mañana," end quote. One is left wondering at this point how credentialed Erasmian scholars could reach such a vastly different conclusion about Erasmus's work than that which is widely promoted in mainstream New Testament scholarship and which has filtered down into the popular mind. Could it be that the rise and promotion of this legend corresponds with the rise and promotion of the modern critical text and the parallel efforts made to dethrone the Textus Receptus? Fifth, Screech makes another point that is largely overlooked by New Testament scholars critical of Erasmus. Namely, he asserts that Erasmus's primary purpose in the Novum Instrumentum was not, in fact, to produce the first printed Greek New Testament, but a new Latin translation. Screech observes, quote, "One curious byproduct of this legend of Erasmus's unseemly haste is that a role has been foisted on it, onto his Greek New Testament, which was never claimed for it. The volume, which Froben printed, is not primarily an edition of the Greek text at all. This is an important point. Erasmus never gave the Greek pride of place in his work as an editor. Where New Testament texts were concerned, his scholarly life was dominated by recensions of the Vulgate. Of course, the evidence of the Greek Testament played a vital part in such work. Of course, he realized that Greek texts needed editing, but that purpose remained subsidiary to another. Erasmus's starting point was the Vulgate, and his goal was a scholarly revision of it. It is often assumed that he translated his own Latin text directly from the Greek. He did not. The enterprise was far more complicated, end quote. Of interest for our study is Screech's point that Erasmus's main purpose was not, in fact, to present a printed edition of the Greek New Testament, but the Latin. This further deflates the notion that Erasmus was in a rush to get to the market with the first printed Greek New Testament. Let's move on, secondly, to the rash wager anecdote. The second Erasmus matter we will examine might be called the rash wager or the rash vow anecdote. It is related to the inclusion of the controversial Coma Johanneum, or the three heavenly witnesses passage, found in 1 John 5, 7b through 8a. This passage did not appear in the first two editions of Erasmus's Greek New Testament, 1516 and 1519. Correspondingly, it did not appear in Luther's 1522 German New Testament. Erasmus added the Coma Johanneum, however, in the third edition of 1522, and so it also appears in Tyndale's 1525 English New Testament. Why did Erasmus choose to include the Coma Johanneum in the third edition? A widely circulated scholarly anecdote suggests that Erasmus made a rash wager or rash vow to include the passage if any Greek manuscript could be produced which contained it. When a forged manuscript, Codex 61, was fabricated by his critics for this very purpose, Erasmus relented and included it, though he was suspicious of its origins. Thus, the spurious Coma Johanneum came to appear both in the Textus Receptus and in the Reformation-era vernacular translations, except again for Luther's German translation, which were made from it. Here is a representative survey providing some examples of the perpetuation of this rash wager anecdote from the 19th century up to the present day. Samuel P. Tregelis describes criticism which Erasmus received from Edward Lee and Stunica for his omission of the Coma Johanneum in his first two editions, adding, quote, "At length, Erasmus promised that if a Greek manuscript were produced which contained the words, he would insert them," end quote. In B.F. Westcott and F.J. Hort's Notes on Select Readings, which accompanied their introduction to the New Testament in the original Greek, the note on the Coma Johanneum at 1 John 5:7 states, quote, "In fulfillment of a rashly given pledge, Erasmus introduced it into the text of his third edition," end quote. J. Harold Greenlee offers this description of how the CJ, the Coma Johanneum, came to be included in Erasmus's third edition. Quote, "The third edition of Erasmus was the first to contain the famous Heavenly Witnesses passage of 1 John 5, 7, and 8. This passage was contained in the Vulgate, and when Sunica, one of Hemene's editors, protested its omission from the Greek text, Erasmus rashly promised to include it in a later edition, if it could be found in a single Greek manuscript. It was accordingly produced from a manuscript, Codex 61, very possibly prepared for the purpose, and Erasmus dutifully fulfilled his promise in his edition of 1522, end quote. Bruce Metzger, likewise, in the early editions of the text of the New Testament, describes Erasmus's response to criticism of the omission of the Coma Johanneum from Stunica. Quote, "In an unguarded moment, Erasmus promised he would insert the Coma Johanneum, as it is called, in future editions, if a single Greek manuscript could be found that contained the passage. At length, such a copy was found, or was made to order, as it now appears. The Greek manuscript had probably been written by a Franciscan friar named Froy, or Roy, who took the disputed words from the Latin Vulgate, end quote. As with the rush to print anecdote, so the rash wager anecdote has also been challenged by an Erasmian specialist. The challenge for this anecdote has come from Dutch scholar Hank Jan de Jong in a 1980 article entitled Erasmus and the Coma Johanneum. De Jong begins by noting, How often must those who lecture in the New Testament or textual criticism at universities the world over have passed on the story of the good faith with which a deceived Erasmus kept his word to the students in their lecture halls? Then de Jong confesses his own guilt. The writer of these lines, he says, cannot plead innocence in this respect. De Jong proceeds to disavow the historical reliability of the anecdote for the following reasons. First, he says, quote, it is remarkable that there is no trace of this tradition in the works of the great experts in the history of the text of the New Testament in the 17th and 18th centuries, end quote. It does not appear, for example, in the writings of Richard Simon, John Mill, or J.J. Wettstein. The earliest reference which de Jong found for the anecdote was in an 1818 work by the prolific scholar T.H. Horn. He adds, quote, it remains unclear from which source Horn derived his information, end quote. Second, he says that the anecdote is told with what he calls striking variations. In some accounts, Erasmus makes the promise to Stunica. In others, to Edward Lee. And still others simply mention the vow without distinguishing to whom it was made. De Jong argues that it is impossible that Erasmus made the promise to Stunica, because he had already decided to add the Coma Johanneum to his text even before the first record of their correspondence in September 1521. He also adds that no such promises to Lee are to be found in any of their surviving correspondence. Third, de Jong notes, quote, the famous promise is not to be found anywhere else, end quote, in Erasmus's extant works. He also expresses his surprise that with the exception of historian Roland H. Bainton, none of the scholars who have passed on the anecdote have even made the slightest effort to ground it in a specific passage in Erasmus or in any other literature of the 16th century. Having marshaled these three formidable arguments, de Jong adds his own opinion that there is insufficient reason to suggest that Erasmus chose to insert the Coma Johanneum because he felt constrained by a promise. After all, Erasmus's chief purpose in the Novum Instrumentum was his Latin text. As de Jong puts it, the function of the Greek text was secondary. According to de Jong, Erasmus added the Coma Johanneum not because of a rash vow or because he believed it to be authentic, but because he simply wanted to avoid the scandal of the charge of a lack of orthodoxy. Finally, de Jong also challenges another facet of the anecdote, which frequently appears in the secondary literature, namely the suggestion that Erasmus himself suspected Codex 61 had been produced to obligate the inclusion of the Coma Johanneum. He observes, quote, this is again a version of events which does not seem to be based on any passage in Erasmus's printed works or letters, end quote. Thus he concludes that it cannot be shown that Erasmus, quote, ever considered Codex Britannicus as a product specially prepared to induce him to include the Coma Johanneum, end quote. The appearance of Erasmus's Novum Instrumentum was, without doubt, a watershed moment in the history of the transmission of the Greek text of the New Testament. Due to the technological revolution of the printing press and to Erasmus's scholarly and editorial labors, for the first time in Christian history, the Greek text of the New Testament was able to achieve a stable and standard form. From Erasmus's Greek text came the various Protestant editions of the Textus Receptus and the vernacular translations which were made from it. The Textus Receptus remained the dominant text until the rise of the modern critical text in the 19th century. It comes as little surprise to discover that during the 19th century, one correspondingly finds a number of anecdotes developing regarding Erasmus and his Greek New Testament, which do not place them in the most flattering light. Many of these anecdotes continued to circulate in the 20th century and even continue to circulate up to the present day. Some Erasmian scholars have challenged the historicity and reliability of these anecdotes. At the least, New Testament scholars should take more care in evaluating and promoting accounts like the rush to print and the rash vow or the rash wager anecdotes, as well as being aware of the possibility of their polemical origins and intents. Some are indeed beginning to do so. With that regard, we can point to the fourth edition of Metzger's The Text of the New Testament, which includes a reference to Hunk de Jong's article and softens the presumption that Erasmus made the so-called rash wager. Other anecdotes that might be mentioned that need to be studied, need further scrutiny, include the question of the number and quality of the Greek manuscripts which Erasmus used to create his Greek text, the origins of Codex 61, the manuscripts Erasmus made use of for his text of Revelation, and the supposed back translation of the final verses of Revelation 22. I hope in the future that I will be able to explore these Erasmus anecdotes as well.